Good afternoon, calling State of Affairs to order at 3:12 p.m. Thursday, February 10th, in the Max Greenberg Room, Alaska Capitol. Members present from my left to my right, Representatives Vance, Kaufman, myself, Chair Christ Tompkins, Representatives Eastman and Story. Five members present constitutes a quorum. Thank you, Sophia and Lydia, as always, for facilitating today's meeting, and Jeff Stepp for making the committee function on a day-to-day basis. A variety of housekeeping, deadline, and schedule-related notes for the committee's reference. As previously shared, if anyone has conceptual contributions to a forthcoming committee substitute on House Bill 142 from Representative McCurdy, please contact my office by noon tomorrow. I know we already have one such taker. Relatively new news, DOA Finance Subcommittee will not meet next Tuesday and Thursday. So we will have the full two-hour blocks, and as such, will not be scheduling a Tuesday hearing as was initially, Tuesday evening hearing as was initially planned, since I think we have enough temporal real estate during our normal windows. Finally, as communicated at 2:20 this afternoon by email, which you haven't seen, you still soon will see, so you have it in writing, a number of amendment deadlines. Monday, 5 o'clock, Representative Prox's HB 158 PFD contributions to general fund amendment deadline. And then also amendment deadlines, Monday, 5 o'clock, 234 and HB 245, the two political contribution limit bills we'll hear today, amendment deadlines. 501 does not count as 5 o'clock. My office, 5 o'clock. And we have another amendment deadline on Wednesday at 5 o'clock, HB 37, Representative Wohl's income tax bill. And for all amendments that might be submitted, contact housestate.affairs@akledge.gov. And just a note, if you anticipate difficulty with getting things drafted on timeline, let my office know, but let us know, you know, before the deadline, and we can try to work and accommodate and figure out a solution, be sort of case-by-case basis, but that's the amendment deadline rundown. Great, and we just noticed next week's schedule, but that's on basis and can be consulted independently. So for today, we have three items on today's agenda, House Bill 245 and House Bill 234, both relating to political contribution limits from Representatives Josephson and Shragi, respectively. I know we're a little rushed, so the idea here is to offer the committee sort of maximum runway for questions, engagement, and we'll close out with HB 251 from Representative Josephson relating to Board of Trustees for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. So with that, Representative Josephson, please join us, Mr. Cohn as well, Staff to Rep. Josephson, and I know you had the opportunity to, with a little bit of a fast tempo, present the bill previously, but if there are any more comments you'd like to make to the committee or anything else to sort of complete the bill presentation, you're most welcome to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Andy Josephson, District 17, Anchorage. And I think I'll use the opportunity you've afforded me. With me is my aide, Max Cohn, to just remind the members what the bill does that's before you. How did we get here? You all sort of know, but the Ninth Circuit, it took a while and it bounced back and forth. It said that our limits were too low. We believe that its main concern was with the fact that they weren't indexed. And so of the four bills in the building, two in the other chamber, I think they're all indexed for inflation. Ours is indexed every 5 years, which should please the court if there was ever another appeal, because that's a little bit faster timeline than another bill. And then for those who would prefer that large donations not overwhelm the system, our bill starts at $700 for a house race. That is not chosen randomly. It is grounded in the $500 that was rejected. However, that was partly rejected by the Ninth Circuit because it was for every race. And we get to 700 by indexing it to inflation from its beginning date, which was maybe '06 or something. Mr. Cohn will remember. But essentially, we can't. What it does in an inflation calculator is it comes up with about $697. So we start at 700. We move to 1,000 for a Senate race and 1,500 for a statewide race. I asked Mr. Cohn today to look at a recent study. This is an 8-month-old study from the NCSL. And I asked specifically, I said, how many states use graduated limits like our bill? And the answer is 25. The states with one limit is just 14. States without limits is 10. So the idea of having a graduated limit is a very typical thing. We have red states and blue states that use that limit. The other thing that I wanted to just mention, all of us here have run a House campaign, and we know, most of us know, that typically we have 18,000 souls in our district and about 12,000 registered voters. And they, of course, live in homes and families. And typically, if you want to write all of them one piece of campaign literature, and I know that's a word we don't often use, but that's the subject of the bill, it costs about $4,000 to communicate with all of them. Well, you can imagine that in a Senate race, it would cost $8,000 to communicate with all of them. And in that respect, having a graduated limit makes some sense. And then finally, Mr. Cohn in his PowerPoint noted that the important test of Randall versus Sorrell, which is what the Ninth Circuit applied, that the Ninth Circuit found we could only check a couple of the tests under current law, and that there's a strong argument that under this bill we would check all five. And then also, I know I said finally, but again, finally, our bill speaks to this out-of-state issue concern, which has been a historic concern in Alaska. Ledge Legal will probably report that it, Ledge Legal, has concerns with that. But just as a reminder, and as identified in the Ninth Circuit case and highlighted in a PowerPoint, the Ninth Circuit said effectively, we're not saying that an out-of-state limit couldn't be crafted that would meet whatever test they might want to apply. And remember that we're going from a $3,000 limit in a House race, which in round one, the Ninth Circuit said too low. That was round one. And we're going up to, well, sort of unlimited, depending on how big the House race gets. But it's likely to be 10 times that number. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative Sisson. Questions from the committee? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. Now, is the goal in this legislation to find, you know, somewhere close to the lowest limit that will get past the courts, or is there another way you arrive at, like, say, $700?
Through the chair, we arrive at $700 in the manner I described, that the people of the state of Alaska, when they were last asked, said we want a $500 limit. And the Ninth Circuit last year said, we don't like that limit. But they didn't prescribe what limit they did like. They just, you know, they offer a lot of dicta and a lot of guidance. And they absolutely insist on indexing. So we do that with $500 and start at $700. But as to the first part of your question, yes, there's a philosophy that campaign limits are valuable tools to avoid quid pro quo corruption. You see in this diagram from NCSL that was given to you by Mr. Stepp through our office, there are only 10 states that dispense with them altogether. So that's not normal. 10 is a few, but it's not typical.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
Now, the five-year reset as far as inflation is concerned, how does that work at the time that the new amount is announced? If it's every 5 years, wouldn't that already fall in the kind of the middle of the current election cycle? So would donations that have been received for that election cycle then go back and apply retroactively, or how would you see that working?
through the chair, or to the chair, and through to Mr. East, or Representative Eastman. I'm going to let Mr. Cohen take a stab at that.
Through the chair, for the record, Max Cohen, staff to Representative Josephson. The way the indexing would work at first is it starts in the first quarter of the calendar year 2023. So that would be following the 2022 elections, presumably before there's much campaigning for 2024. And then it'll happen 5 years after that. So in 2028, and in the same time of the year. That would be in January 2028, 5 years, 2023. If that timing seems to the committee like it would cause disruptions in campaigns, going forward 1 year or one fewer from the 5 years, my understanding from the sponsor would be within the general scope of this bill.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on Section 6 having to do with the non-resident contributions. And I think we briefly discussed it at the last meeting about the 50% of the total contributions. Mm-hmm. But if there's such a concern about limiting the outside influence, it seems like the 50% is much more generous than what we previously had. Mm-hmm. With the graduated approach. I like the percentage approach. I think that's a really smart way to do it. But why did you come upon the 50% as the number for the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, that number I can't say is grounded in the same way the $700 is mathematically. Mr. Cohn was in Anchorage working in my office there in the fall, and we had we were together reading all of these Ninth Circuit and Supreme Court decisions. That was his main task and mine with him. And we talked about the Ninth Circuit's rejection of the $3,000 limit. And I think if I can take credit, or maybe I want him to take the credit, concluded that the Ninth Circuit did open the door and say, there may be something you could fashion. We're not sure what it is, but there may be something. And I thought, well, geez, surely, you know, if more than half your money comes from out of state, that doesn't pass the red face test for Alaskans. It's incredibly generous in terms of expanding out of state contributions. It seems reasonable. And it's the foundation for it is no more than that.
Follow up. The other question I have is, because it's based on a percentage, how do you see APOC and really the candidate implementing this to make sure that they're being accountable as their campaign contributions are coming in?
Through the chair, that's a good question. It was asked by a colleague of yours on the committee. And I'm open to guidance in terms of amendments that might help make the statute or the bill better. Presumably, if you'd raised $40,000 from Alaskans and had raised $39,000 from out of state, and it was November 1st, and your cousin in Tennessee said, I want to give you, under this bill, $700, which she could do or he could do, you could accept that, but you'd have to monitor it. And if they said, I want to give you $2,000, first you'd say, well, that's above the limit. Can't do that. But you'd also say it violates you would go beyond my 50% limit. And I take your point. I don't know quite how to craft it perfectly. But it would be something that a candidate would have to monitor. I do think that in most circumstances, thankfully, they wouldn't come close to that line.
Representative Story, did you still have a question? Okay. And just for the record, Representative Tarr joins at 316 and Representative Klayman at 326. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor, pondering the graduated limits, so a representative running has half of what a Senate district has, and so there's already a limit in that you just don't have the population to access. So if you're running for a House seat, you already have a smaller audience by the nature of the position. But some costs are fixed, or the economy of scale is tilted against the smaller district position. So if you're running for a smaller seat relative to numbers, but some of your costs are going to be similar to somebody that can do the same thing in a district double that size, it seems a little unfair to put, you're basically putting two drags on it. You already have the smaller population that's going to be concerned about your race, and then you have an additional dollar limit. So it just seems like it doubles down on an inherent challenge of running in a, you know, for a position representing a smaller population.
Through the chair, I'm not, President Kaufman, I'm not directly following. Right now, well, previous to November, the limit was $500. Under this bill, it would be $700. And 5 years later, it would be indexed to be $900 or whatever it might become. I understand that, well, for example, typically you'd have one campaign manager, whether you were running for the House or the Senate. So I understand some of the economies of scale, but I don't quite understand what you're asking.
Well, if it's reasonable to scale the dollar value down for the seat, since the population is already scaled down and you have fixed costs. So let's just say you're going to buy a radio commercial, without radio commercial would overlap and it costs what it costs in that marketplace. So the House candidate is already at a numerical disadvantage because of the population that might be interested in donating to the race. Whereas the Senate has double that population to draw from. So for certain things in a campaign, there's just a certain cost of entry, certain baseline costs. And if you have a dollar value reduction for that position, as well as the smaller population, it just seems like it's challenging that process a little bit.
I'm going to let Mr. Kuhn comment, but I would say that, I'm just going to let Mr. Kuhn comment. I had a thought.
Through the chair, Max Cohn, staff to Rep. Josephson, I think, at least thinking through how the courts sometimes look at these limits, what they're often interested in is, does a challenger have a fair chance against an incumbent? So within a House race, it might be fair to compare what two candidates might be able to do. But in terms of whether or not a House race and a Senate race are comparable competitively, we haven't seen that question arise in other cases. And because a House candidate isn't competing against a Senate candidate, I don't know if there is a potential mismatch. I'm not sure that that would be infringing on the chance for there to be a fair competition, which is essentially what the courts are usually seeking in these laws.
Thank you. Through the chair, it's not that I'm comparing the House to the Senate in terms of the challenge. I'm just saying that there's certain barriers to entry to running for office. I mean, you've got to be able to, you know, to pull together money, or in some cases, some people fund it themselves to get started. And just pointing out that if you have a sample population that's smaller and you have a dollar value limit that's lower, but you have certain pieces of the process they cost what they cost, no matter whether you're campaigning to a House or a Senate district, a radio commercial is probably one of the best ones. It just seems like it's kind of doubling down on a thing. It's just making it that much more challenging for that race by limiting it. But there's two limits going on that I just want to get it out there and you know, give it a little thought as we have this discussion.
Just my only comment, I think it was what I was thinking of before, is that you said something before about suggesting that donations would come from within the district. And of course, they generally come outside one's district, probably by a lot. So I don't, for example, measure per se contributions that come to me from House District 17. It's not something I measure. So I guess I'm not fully understanding.
Final thought, comment, or question, Representative Kaufman?
We'll follow up on that through the chair. Hopefully, donations would, at least significant portions, would come from within the district. I think we all hope for that. But I think most importantly, it's a matter of importance. You know, if you're going to run for office, you get a lot more airtime if you're, let's say, running for a statewide race or something like that, and you get a lot more exposure. You get it, these smaller races, they're already challenged just by being smaller, and that they're in the quest to represent, you know, one of the smallest divisions of people that we have. And so I kind of respect the idea that things scale down, but there's a natural scaling that already occurs. And I'm just suggesting that this double scaling, it's, you know, worth thinking about. That's all. Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. I applaud the sponsor's effort to honor the will of the people the last time that they were able to speak on the issue of the campaign limits. It does occur to me, however, that the circumstances that they were dealing with at the time that they cast those votes are very, very different than the circumstances that we encounter today, were they to be voting today. And two things which just make a world of difference are, one, we have ballot measure 2, which is passed now, which was not the case when they were voting, and Citizens United. And I think either or both of those just totally changed the dynamics and would likely change how people would vote on the issue. Have you considered the expense, the changing nature of expenses going into a prop, you know, post Prop 2 election like we have coming up? Have you done any modeling about how much more those races might cost with the different way the election is run? I mean, before, a lot of these races were handled in the primary at smaller cost, smaller number of voters. Now, going into the general, I would anticipate that a lot of those costs are going to be higher.
Through the chair, I absolutely have not done any modeling, but I would say that the opposite would be true relative to primaries as well. That is, most, you know, four candidates are guaranteed a seat at the November dinner table, so to speak. And so, if there's four. And so in that respect, there would need, assuming you're comfortable, you're going to be one of the four, and often people will be, you would need to spend fewer resources on the primary. So, but no, I haven't done any modeling. I wouldn't know how to do that.
Follow up. Thank you. And let's talk about Citizens United for a moment. You know, I'm looking at this bill and some others that are going through the legislature right now, and I'm saying, wow, this is something that I would have expected before Citizens United, but is it even applicable now based on the high dollar numbers that are being spent on races? I mean, I look at the $700 limit, and then I look at the Snyder-Pruitt race, and I say, wow, $700 isn't much if we're talking about, you know, $700,000 or more on a single house race. How should we be looking at the fact that you have an opportunity for almost unlimited money, and yet we're having a relatively small limit of $700?
Through the chair, to Representative Eastman, a couple things. The first thing is that a person can still contribute, not unlimited to a party, or I'd have to think about a group, and Mr. Cohn will know that better, but they can, using the benefits of Citizen United and PAC contributions, et cetera, an individual can give very generously to those entities. The prohibition is on them coordinating with the candidate. And so here, because the coordination can occur, I'm giving you this $1,500, Representative Josephson, allowed by APOC, and I strongly recommend you support XYZ, or I strongly recommend when you send out a mailer that it say ABC, perfectly legal. Not common, but the former, maybe certainly not the latter. But So that's part of it, is that you get that direct connection. You're not going through a go-between to get to the candidate. And the other thing I would say is the courts repeatedly, the highest court in the land and the Ninth Circuit, have said limits are important to prevent quid pro quo corruption. So, again, 40 states have limits. The other 10 could have limits. They choose not to. So the answer is sort of completed by the decisions themselves, where the most important courts in the land say, yeah, we understand limits. We get it.
Final follow-up.
Follow-up.
So in the situation where you've got the individual with the $1,500 making a direct contribution in the current election cycle versus that same individual saying, wow, $1,500 isn't that much. I'm going to go and I'm going to spend more money on independent expenditure. And then, you know, there's no quid pro quo at the time. But have you really solved anything with that $1,500 or $700 limit if at the end of the election, you know, you have it very obvious to everybody involved in the race that an individual spent, you know, $3,000 or maybe a lot more on independent expenditure? And now going into the next election, the question is, well, are they going to do it again or are they not going to do it again? I mean, is this limit solving for the potential harm, like you're talking about, of that relationship between a donor and a politician?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, with great respect, and I mean this, often in my hearings, I can't make the world perfect. Can't do it. I'm trying to make it better. And you're asking me, the way I interpret your question is, can you make it perfect? I can't. The courts have had the kind of conversations you're having. And so in that respect, you're spot on. And all I can tell you is they've said, because of the First Amendment interest, when it comes to this sort of ambiguous entity called a PAC, you know, Katie bar the door, just go for it. But when it comes to a direct contribution, they've continually said these are okay to protect democracy. And I don't know that I can contribute a whole lot more to that. I think any one of us in this room would be concerned with, for example, and this is just one element of the bill, raising $100,000 for a house race, which typically should be adequate, and learning that your opponent has gotten $200,000 from their cousin from Tampa. Now, you could make that an issue. That would be an issue the voters would want to hear about. But your cousin from Tampa still sent you $200,000. So we're trying to control the amount of money, and we're trying to say that he or she that can only give you $20, that's meaningful. Your $20 matters. And that's an important thing, too.
Thank you.
Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I read the Supreme Court opinion in the Thompson matter that we have, the basis upon which we can restrict the First Amendment right to contribute to a campaign is essentially quid pro quo corruption or its appearance. That's how I read that case, that you get to limit your contributions if you think there's a basis for finding corruption. That's the target of these restrictions, because otherwise First Amendment would say, if I want to give $100,000 to a candidate to support them, I can. So this is the challenge that I have with this graded pay, this limit by what the election is for. And it's from the standpoint of the contributor. It seems to me that if I'm a contributor, that I shouldn't have my speech restricted upon who I'm contributing to in a race. So in other words, I may feel like my Senate candidate in a state Senate race, I feel less powerfully to speak out in support of that person than my House candidate. Or a House candidate in a different district because I'm the candidate. But it doesn't seem to me that I should have my speech restricted on how much I give to the House candidate any differently than what I give to the Senate candidate. I'm troubled with this notion that my speech should be restricted, because I see the Thompson cases and the whole line of cases saying it has to be connected to corruption to limit the speech. And that's why I've struggled with these graded limits.
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, you weren't here at the beginning. I know you were in an important committee hearing on a bill I support, incidentally. but we provided...
So you left the committee.
We provided this document, which shows from the NCSL that 25 states use graduated limits. It's a policy call. It's a policy call designed to allow some allowance for a Senate race, which typically you've got in Alaska 36,000 people to write and to speak to rather than 18,000. And it's designed to tamp down on the system being overwhelmed by cash. And, the other thing is, frankly, one of the reasons we went with the graduated system is that we wanted to respect the court's decision. By the way, it's not a Supreme Court decision, Ninth Circuit decision. We wanted to respect the Ninth Circuit's decision that 500 was too low. We would submit, because the court seemed to say this, that it was too low, partly because it wasn't graduated for other races. In fact, the same Ninth Circuit, different panel, but same court, in Lair versus Motel in 2017, a Montana race, approved rates quite a bit lower. In fact, for example, for House, I think it was like $170 per race, so $340, primary general together. So it's hard to read these and know precisely what is this court wanting me to do. Very tricky. In Montana, in Alaska, they seem to say, we don't like this $500 thing. In Montana, they were okay with $340. So what we tried to do in part was to reflect that the bigger the race, not that a House race isn't as big as a Senate race, metaphorically, but the bigger the race, the more expensive the race, typically true. But also we wanted to respect the Ninth Circuit by anchoring this thing at $700, and I explained early on in this hearing where we achieved that number, and then move up from there. But it's a policy call.
Follow up.
Oh.
I suppose one of the challenges I have is, in terms of the precedent from the courts, it has struck me that the line of cases, and really exemplified by this per curiam opinion by the Supreme Court in Thompson, that I'm not sure we can look at pre-2019 cases as necessarily where the Ninth Circuit or any other federal district or federal appellate court would be in more recent years. I think there's just a lot of uncertainty, part by Citizens United, part of decisions like this. And so I guess I just keep coming back not to to where's the justification for restriction on speech. And I just have a hard time saying that for the individual's restriction on speech, that I should have the ability to speak louder in a U.S. Senate race and a U.S. House race by how much money I'm allowed to spend than I can spend in a state House race or a state Senate race, or for that matter, a state governor's race. I'm just troubled with that disparity, because it seems to me that if we're talking about what can we infringe on the First Amendment right and how is that tied to corruption, I don't see how you can make the connection between limiting how much the campaign can spend to showing that there's the corruption.
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, a couple things. First of all, Citizens doesn't change the analysis because the decision is way past Citizens United. It's also way past Randall versus Sorrell, which I think is 2006, a Vermont case. And that was the seminal case. The Supreme Court said, Ninth Circuit, go read Randall. And so their whole decision in Thompson versus Hebden, which is why we're here today, no other reason we're here today but Thompson v. Hebden, the number two, their second decision, was because of Randall. And again, the Randall case, I think, is 15 years old. So the world has changed, but in a sense, not in the last few years. And then as to your other question about I mean, you're making an argument that I respect. I will tell you, it tends to be made more generally by more conservative people than people concerned with cash in the system. That's fine. All I can tell you is that the courts have said repeatedly that it matters what seat is at play. That matters. They've expressed concern repeatedly with direct contributions impacting races because the threat of corruption and because you can speak to that candidate directly.
Follow up in a slightly different area, and then I'll let others have a shot. I'm also concerned with treating this on a per year limits as opposed to per election limits. And I'm particularly concerned about this because of the Ninth Circuit opinion talks about the factors to consider. High on that is the advantages of incumbency. And it strikes me that the annual limits give a substantial advantage to incumbents because traditionally challengers usually don't sign up for these elections until within the last 30 days before the filing deadline. And so they're typically in a one-year campaign fundraising cycle. And the incumbent has been working the prior year, so they're behind the curve. The challengers are historically behind the curve, and they've never been able to, other than creating more work for APOC and creating more regulations, it seems like election limits would be better than annual limits, which has been the tradition in Alaska. But the second part of this is very Anchorage specific because we have this 18-month window on contributions under the APOC law, which applies to the municipal election. And because the Anchorage municipal election is in April, what it means is that the organized incumbent, regardless of the limits, can go in and triple dip. They can go in the last 2 months of the year, 3 years before, can rate like so for this April election in Anchorage. They could raise money in the last 2 months of 2020. They could raise money in all of 2021 and then raise money in the 4 months before the election in 22. And they have this huge advantage over any challenger because the typical challenger signs up maybe in January and can raise what they can in 3 or 4 months. And so if part of what we're trying to do is tailor these to give challengers a shot, and I say this as an incumbent, it seems to me there's a fundamental flaw in annual limits, that we should be having campaign limits in every election because that's the best way to level the playing field and give a challenger a decent shot.
To the chair, through the chair, to Representative Klingman, there's a lot to chew on there. When Mr. Cohn and I had long discussions about this, because I recall this, I think he'll agree, we decided to stay with the annual limits because that's what Alaska does. And because the Ninth Circuit had no issue with that. No issue with that. And we just thought that was where the comfort level was. As one thing I will say that I disagreed with in the Thompson v. Hebden decision, there were a number of things I disagreed with. For example, they minimized the Vico scandal. They thought that was no big deal. Literally, their opinion says this is really no big deal, even though I think 7 members in this building were indicted and handcuffed. But that's what they said. They also noted that what you said, they were concerned with challengers, but they neglected to mention that challengers can be having fundraisers tonight, and you and I can't. Now, the governor can, and that's why I commended to you Senator Wilikowski's idea of amending that. I don't want to have a fundraiser during the session. I'm busy doing session stuff. Okay? But if you want us on an equal playing field with the governor, you would stop him from being able to do that. I'm not looking to join him in the right to have a fundraiser tonight. The main answer is that the cycles versus races issue is, it was just where Alaska's comfort seemed to be.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Clayman, Representative Josephson. In the queue, we have Representative Story and Representative Kaufman and Representative Eastman and myself, and I'm going to afford those who haven't yet asked questions the first opportunity would be Representative Story and myself, and then we'll go around just to make sure that there's equal opportunity. Representative Tarr, of course, you're welcome to put yourself in the queue if you'd like and jump line, so to speak. Also, just from a time management perspective, I think important bill, both of these, and would like to ultimately work towards a conclusion. So I think my thought would be we just sort of give maximum runway for HBs 245 and 234 today, and whatever time we may have, we can allot to 251, but just make sure that everybody is able to fully engage on these two pieces of legislation. So with that, Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And my question is more of a comment, and I appreciate the discussion and thoroughly vetting all of this. But one comment I wanted to raise is most people who are running for a House position, this is my observation, is they're running for their first time. Typically, it's a Senate position as someone who has been in the system before. And so to me, the lower rate gets the newcomers who have never thought about running for office before, who kind of intimidated by all the money they have to raise. And I think House races should definitely be lower caps than Senate races. It just makes sense. And I really want people to feel that elections are accessible to them. Myself, as being a homemaker, active volunteer, it's intimidating to run for office, and it's nice to make it feel approachable and asking people for money. And it's good to have a wide base. That's really what gets a lot of people there. But I just appreciate the discussion today and just wanted to add that.
Thank you, Representative Story. I have a couple of questions, and then we'll go to other members of the committee. And I should have mentioned this earlier, apologies, but online we have Tom Lucas with APOC, Morgan Griffin, the AAG at the Department of Law, and Alpheus Bullard with Legislative Legal available for questions. And I'm actually going to avail myself to that.
Mr. Chairman, can I say something super fast?
You can, Representative.
I'm going to say something that's going to surprise you. In some respects.
Really?
Yes. In some respects, if you wanted to reset or adjourn this hearing for the day relatively soon, that's fine with me because I've got duties down the hall. So if you're trying to strive for balance with my colleague behind me, that'd be great.
I think it in terms of which bill is sort of technically consuming time, I actually see it as very interchangeable. Sure. Since the fundamental issues are at play. So I very much appreciate that. But it's almost sort of a commingled approach. And for instance, the questions I ask have bearing on both bills. And I was going to ask Mr. Bullard, Representative Josephson mentioned this, I think, in his introductory comments at today's hearing, but can you share Legislative Legal's perspective on out-of-state contribution limits? I'm asking mostly just to sort of have it on the record and as a point of reference.
Good afternoon. This is Alpheus Bullard of Leg Legal. Members of the committee, Chair, are you able to hear me?
We are, loud and clear.
Once again, for the record, this is Alpheus. I don't know so much that Leg Legal has a perspective, but I'd be happy to speak to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, Thompson versus Hebden decision. And they found that our state's aggregate limits, in my interpretation of the reading of the case, just could not be targeted towards quid pro quo corruption, because with an aggregate limit, one contribution is fine, and then the one that follows it is the one that's too many. It's not that the second contribution is corrupt. It's just unfortunately, it's one contribution too far. And so while it might be, it might be a law that prohibits undue influence from out of state, that aggregate limits just cannot be targeted at quid pro quo corruption. I think their language was that it's a poor fit to addressing corruption. And so that was the perspective of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Mr. Bullard. And Mr. Griffin with the Department of Law, are you with us?
Yes.
Excuse me, Ms. Griffin. Same question. What if the Department of Law has a perspective on Thompson v. Hebden and the relative constitutionality of out-of-state contribution limits given that decision?
For the record, Assistant Attorney General Morgan Griffin for the Department of Law. Chair, I can't answer that question for you now, but I can, I guess, see if I can bring an answer back to the committee.
Thank you. That would be appreciated. Does the Department of Law have any perspective on as the legislature considers policy, given the Thompson v. Hebden decision, does the Department of Law have a perspective on what parameters may exist or that the legislature may be well advised to take into consideration in terms of what may withstand judicial review and what may not?
Okay, yes. So if I can be clear, so in my role, although I am a Department of Law attorney, in my role as counsel for APOC staff, as a more neutral body, it's normally the advice that I provide the commission is based on the law, not based on what the Department of Law wants, if that makes sense. And the issue of out-of-state contributions, I know at least that the commission has not been enforcing at least the statute. And Mr. Lucas is on the line. You know, he is the one who's, you know, he's practicing following these laws every day in his practice. But I can absolutely see if I can get more information on the out-of-state contribution limits and bring that information back to the committee.
Thank you. Yeah, it sounds like you're maybe not the right representative from the Department of Law for the question I had in mind, and that's not a fault at all. If it is possible to share any perspective the Department of Law has on this general issue, sort of run the trap lines within the agency and share that with the committee, I, for one, would be interested.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Let's see. Next, we have Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor. With respect to the NCSL handout dated June 21st that was placed here, there's three respective models, states with graduated limits, states with one limit for all candidates, and states without any limits. And just to pick on the first states that show up alphabetically, so Arizona, Arkansas, and Alabama each fall into those three different categories. Do we have any indication that that those states in these categories are more corrupt than states in other categories? Is there evidence that one model is inherently less corrupt than the other? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, there is in what is called dicta, which is part of an opinion but not the holding of the opinion. There's occasional reference by one judge or another, depending on the case, to sort of broad discussion of that, because I recall that. But no, I don't. I can't tell you. I know, for example, it'd be interesting to see. Well, I know that Rhode Island has had its problems. It has had its problems, but with corruption. But I that's not much of a statistic. And Louisiana, I'm told, but that isn't much of a statistical sample.
Follow up.
And just as always, I like pursuing root causes of things. So it, you know, hence the question. Just that's always the way my mind works. And the other was around the question of fairness, of equality of opportunity, and kind of a speech issue, or let's say at least an advocacy issue. So, you know, the tale of two voters or two supporters of a candidate, one is disabled or elderly, somehow not able to engage in physical activity that may benefit a campaign, but they can contribute money. The other is, let's say, much more robust, but they don't have the financial assets to be able to donate and can just put in endless effort, door-to-door work, making phone calls, just campaign super volunteer, whatever. So does a financial limit impose upon the person who is disabled, unable to express themselves physically for the campaign, relative to the person that can provide much more dollar value in those physical efforts? So does it create an imbalance, an unfairness between those two models that I described? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, normally when I think of disabled or elderly voters, I think of voting access, which is other bills in this building, but not a contribution bill. These opinions, so I think it's McConnell or McDowell, it's Sorrell, McCutcheon, Randall v. Sorrell, the Thompson decisions, even if you want to throw in Buckley and others historically, they do talk about volunteers, and some of these states take into consideration sort of in-kind value of volunteering. That gets some discussion in these opinions. It's usually not the main heart of the decision. I don't think it factors into my bill at all. I certainly, as I get older, I'm envious of young people because their bodies they don't creak and crack. And that's just, I just view that as if you've got young people with lots of good shoes, then that's an advantage. I don't know what else I can say.
Although, through the chair to the bill sponsor, thank you. Yeah, in the sense of it being a contribution, with a financial equivalence, maybe not so much, but in terms of being able to express one's support, it goes to that fundamental aspect of supporting people. But thank you. This interesting discussion today. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair. Now, I know that you're well aware of the topic, but I wanted to put it on the record and get your perspective. It would seem to me that a very wealthy candidate has a distinct advantage, and that advantage grows the lower that an individual contribution limit is, because they have access to the funds needed to fund their campaign, whereas a less well-off candidate then has to reach out to more people, and the lower that limit is, the more people they have to find to give money to their campaign. And I was just wondering, have you considered that disparity, and how do you see it?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I haven't really considered that disparity, except as a citizen of the state and the country and watching some of what you described happen. I'm a believer in contribution limits. I'm with these 40 states that have contribution limits. It's an advantage for the affluent. Sometimes they pay a political price for it, as we know. So beyond that, I don't know what I can contribute.
Follow up. Thank you. Currently, I think to this point in the campaign, there's been a $1,500 limit. So if we were to adopt this $700 limit, that would be certainly less, obviously. In the analysis that the courts have done, which allow for these individual limits to offset the potential of quid pro quo corruption, I'm gonna go out on a limb and guess that a lot of these states that have been doing that probably don't have the same mechanism in our state law that allows a candidate to file for one office and then decide to switch to a different office and put all or most of the money into a future campaign account and then put it into that new campaign and then go back to the same donors that gave them previously and ask them to donate again to the new campaign in the same election cycle. Just going to guess that there's not a lot of states that do that. Since we do, it would seem to me that these low limits that we're looking at in this bill would, if anything, encourage people to do things like that. So I know that that hasn't been as big of an issue in the past, but I think under this bill, it might become more of an issue.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I'd have to hear a second time what you said, but I will tell you one thing that I thought of. You mentioned future campaign accounts. That's a term of art in Alaska. They're very restricted. I think in a House race, it's $5,000. So I'm not sure I would use that term because that's super restricted. It is true that a person under our system, Mr. Lucas, I think will know this better than me, can file a letter of intent, not declare the office before June 1, move from House to Senate, Lieutenant Governor to Governor, et cetera. But they'd still, I think, be stuck with the same limit. If they wanted to carry that money with them to a different race, first of all, the moment they say, I'm running for House, they're stuck, as I understand it. They couldn't carry that to a Senate race. So there's that restriction. But if they haven't declared, they can't, they can go to their donor and say, I said I was running for the House, now I'm running for the Senate. And the donor, I guess, would say, yeah, that's fine, but I already gave you the money. What do you want from me? I mean, so I'm not sure what your question is exactly. And I'm not sure that I know the differences with the other states anyway.
Follow up. Yes, actually, it wouldn't give the candidate any benefit to run for House and then run for some other office. The benefit is in, say, running for governor, which has a much higher threshold for future campaign accounts. Mm-hmm. So you would take that donation, and then you would move, say, to Senate next, and then you would go back to the same donors, get more money, and then you would potentially move down the line until you get to House at the end. That's the way to game the system if you wanted to, you know, go and get around your $700 campaign limit, so to speak, in that same election cycle. So that's how you would do it. I'm not recommending that, but it seems with these lower limits, it's creating an incentive, a greater incentive, to go that path.
Through the chair, since we've never had a graduated system, we don't have any experience with it. Once you've declared for governor, again, you're sort of stuck in that race. Now, of course, you're not stuck in the race, Representative Eastman. It's a free country. You can withdraw. But your funds are for that race. Well, I guess we ask Mr. Lucas.
Mr. Lucas.
I'd like to, and just to get the
opinion for my part. Yeah, and I will put him on. Mr. Lucas, can you provide some clarity on this factual question?
Tom Lucas, Campaign Disclosure Coordinator for the Alaska Public Offices Commission.
Thank you. Did you follow the question about whether, let me see if I can restate it, funds raised for a particular office, say governor, must be used or confined for candidacy for that office?
I did follow it, and Representative Eastman's scenario is possible. Someone could file for governor, close out the race, and be able to put $50,000 into a future campaign account, then file for Senate, close out the race, and be able to put, but then they could only put $10,000 into a future campaign account.
Thank you. Representative Eastman, last question.
Just to circle, complete the circle. The benefit and the incentive for the low campaign limit is that not that you would take $50,000 and then put it in a Senate race and then take $10,000, which the math doesn't work there. It's that you have the opportunity, if you do that, to go to the same donor and collect three maximum contributions. So instead of $700, you end up with $2,100, you know, towards that race. So that's the question I'm posing, since that is an option in Alaska, unless, you know, your bill would go to change that, which it doesn't currently. Just have you considered that low limit is creating an incentive there? That's all.
Through the chair, I would offer an amendment if I were in your shoes. I think that the donor would say, candidate, you have a problem with indecision. and I'm frustrated with you, and I'm done with you. But, you know, beyond that, I don't know what to say.
Thank you.
And a question for Mr. Lucas is, I may not have tracked the thread of the dialogue, but is there anything that prevents that scenario at present or even prior to Thompson v. Hebden?
Tom Lucas, through the chair, there is not anything that would preclude that scenario. Of course, because of the statute in terms of future campaign accounts, obviously the best way, if you wanted to do that, would be to run for governor first and be able to stash $50,000. But then after that, you're not able to stash, you're only $10,000 for a state senate and $5,000 for house. But there is nothing in the statute currently or in the past before, after this statute passed, and I do not have when that statute passed at my fingertips, but there's nothing that would stop a person from doing that.
And Mr. Lucas, are you familiar with anyone having done that previously in your tenure at APOC?
We have had people change offices, and they have had to close out their campaign, and they have had, and they were able to put money up to the limit into a future campaign account for the next campaign. I do not recall that has ever happened in a governor campaign where the person running for governor has stashed $50,000 and decided to run for Senate or House.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it strikes me as a loophole in the FCA statutes that perhaps hasn't been exploited up until now, or period. Might be exploited in 2022 for all we know and the attention we're casting on the issue in this moment. It does strike me as something that could merit an amendment, really independent of what the right approach on campaign contribution limits is, because I would just add, it seems like there's a further disincentive that it's such a blatantly cynical maneuver that a disincentive to do so would be the voters might not appreciate it once it comes to light, but I suppose everyone would consider the pros and cons of that. Representative Joseph.
I think Mr. Cohn would like to make a comment that's relevant.
Yeah, just one additional comment on this. On this conversation, there have been graduated limits in Alaska before Thompson versus Hebden in the non-resident aggregate limits. So theoretically, whatever was stopping people from abusing those different limits, if you were running for governor, you could raise 50, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, I think 50,000 from out of state. If you're running for the House, you could only raise 5,000 or 3,000 from out of state. So that type of loophole, if it exists, already existed. It'd be maybe an interesting question for Mr. Lucas.
Mr. Lucas, that was a roundabout way of asking a question. If you checked that, please feel free to comment.
There was a graduated amount for the aggregate limit in the statute before, of course, that was struck down. And I don't know how to answer the question other than that.
It's okay. I think we can leave it there. And I have no one else in the queue. And even if I did, I think we'd want to afford Representative Shari the opportunity to be in front of the committee for a little bit, although there's less quote-unquote surface area in his legislation. So potentially less potential questions. Thank you very much, Representative Joseph and Mr. Cohn. Representative Shragi and Mr. Gunders.
Not it.
Recently?
Oh, yeah.
Representative Shoggy.
Thank you, Chair Christ Tompkins. An honor to be here before the committee again. Appreciate the opportunity to have our bill heard for a second time now, and appreciated the discussion of the last committee hearing. I think given the robust discussion that's already occurred on the prior bill, I'm going to keep things very short. And, I think we're all familiar with why we're here and what this bill does, and I'd just like to leave as much time for questions as possible. So I think I'd like to just jump right into there and see what questions the committee has.
Questions from the committee? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and thank you for coming back to us. I don't remember when you walked into the room. We did have some advice from one of the attorneys at Ledge Legal talking about how the court has addressed the aggregate limit and basically not being able to find, and maybe we can bring it back if you didn't hear. Were you there for that conversation?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, we were watching online.
Okay, good. All right, so it's something that at least we're familiar with. And I wanted to go back to our last time we chatted, and you had pulled a portion of your bill based on the aggregate limits and whatnot. And from what you heard from the attorney, does that change your opinion on whether or not you'd like to bring that part back into your bill? Because it seemed to me that it made sense to have it out, and I know you kind of reconsidered in the CS, it's not there anymore.
And to be clear, Representative Eastman, through the chair, you're talking about the out-of-state contribution limits, is that correct?
Yes, the aggregate out-of-states. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to pass that to my aide, Eric Gunderson, as I believe he was maybe a little bit more familiar with that discussion than I was.
So our original bill, through the chair, for the record, Eric Gunderson, staff representative Shoggy. Our original bill essentially was just stripping the language already in statute that the Ninth Circuit and the Thompson versus Hebden decision struck down as unconstitutional. In our CS, we essentially are leaving the language there in statute.
Follow up. And so my question is, should we still be leaving it there in statute? I mean, the court did, tell us in so many ways that they didn't like it. And my understanding from hearing Mr. Klein that they didn't like it because there's no way to make it be a good fit for the purpose of limiting quid pro quo corruption, because you end up not treating one donation the same based on whether it's about to hit or has just hit the cap. And so there's no way to say, well, that one was more corrupt and that one was less corrupt. And so I think there was maybe some ambiguity in our last hearing over whether or not we could make that work. And so I'm wondering your thoughts now.
Yes, I think just for clarity, it might have been Mr. Bullard that made those comments.
Thank you.
Representative Shari.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, and my apologies, it may have been when I was walking over to committee. I may have missed some part of the discussion. Our intent is to leave that language in statute, but it's our understanding that that will be unenforceable. We do not intend to rectify the out-of-state limit being struck down by the court. It's our interpretation from the guidance provided by the courts that there is no workable out-of-state limit, at least not that we can envision at this time, and so we have not taken that up through this bill.
Thank you.
Representative Klayman.
So I ask you some of the same questions I asked Representative Josephson. First, in terms of the annual limit versus campaign limit, particularly the Ninth Circuit's discussion about how are challengers handicapped versus incumbents. And it strikes me in state races to some extent because you've got 2 years and the incumbent tends to raise money for both years, whereas the challenger often doesn't get organized until just before filing deadlines. But particularly in Anchorage, so they get the incumbents tend to get two bites at the contribution apple, whereas the challengers often only get one. And it's even worse in Anchorage because of the timing of when the elections line up with the 18-month window allows any organized candidate, but historically usually only organized incumbents can actually get three dips. And it seems to me that those campaign limits annual limits are very favorable to incumbents, whereas aggregate or campaign limits are better for challengers. Where are you in terms of campaign limits versus annual limits? I know your bill says annual limits, but how committed are you to those?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman. So I think I'd like to make 2 points. One is that from the guidance that we've received from the courts through these various decisions, it has been stated that as you increase the contribution limits, it diminishes the advantage that an incumbent has in fundraising for a campaign. So I believe by increasing our limits to a higher threshold, it does to some extent minimize or diminish that challenge of being able to run a challenger campaign. The second thing I'd like to say is that I find your argument compelling, and I am very open to an amendment that would move this to a per-election cycle limit. So I think there are some mitigating factors in our bill that help to alleviate that concern, but very open to the idea of going to a campaign cycle limit.
And then follow up. The second area of inquiry, so the federal limits to both House candidates, U.S. House and U.S. Senate for the full campaign, I think it's $2,900 per election, but the primary is considered one election and the general is considered one election. So for all intents and purposes, it's a $5,800 limit. And from the donor's perspective and the donor's First Amendment right to express their opinion through contributions, it strikes me that it's hard for me to justify to come up with a reason why we should be able to express our speech less in a state House race or a state Senate race or even a governor's race than we can in a U.S. House and U.S. Senate race. Why shouldn't we just be applying assume we agree to an election cycle as opposed to, why shouldn't we just be tracking the federal limits?
Well, Representative Klayman, through the chair, with respect to the federal limits, I mean, as we discussed in the prior hearing, I think there has been an expressed concern by the citizens of Alaska that we want to see lower limits. I, in crafting this bill, have recognized the implications of Citizens United and the fact that really the only legitimate reason that we have to restrict free speech in this way, our ability to advocate in campaigns through our donations, is to eliminate or avoid the appearance or actuality of quid pro quo contributions or actions that are made. So all that is to say, while I think the federal limits do provide more ceiling and limit that speech less, I think that Alaskans, through their prior initiatives, have expressed a strong desire to see a lower limit than that. And so we've attempted to strike a balance that does just that, balances that strong desire from the citizens to see a lower limit with what I think is clearly, through court cases in the past, a constitutionally valid limit that you would see through the federal limits. I hope that's a clear answer and that you're tracking.
Yeah, I'm tracking. Thank you.
How would you feel about an amendment to close the FCA loophole as discussed 10 minutes ago?
FCA, through the chair, could you...
Future campaign account.
Oh, thank you very much. I'd like to pass that off to my.
You can also respond later.
I think that's a good.
Catching
we'll circle back on that one.
Thank you. But if you didn't catch, there's committee discussion. Mm-hmm. I can't remember if you were in or out of the room on that subject. Representative Klayman.
This is more comment on that particular topic. I think the so-called loophole on future campaign account limits. I think it may technically exist, but I think in reality, I think the practical reality is it doesn't arise because it takes so much just to be organized to have the bank account and be organized to fundraise. The notion that you're going to sort of try to game the system by doing some stuff with future campaign accounts, it just seems incredibly unlikely. And the fact we've never seen it happen is a sign that, we could spend a bunch of time to close a loophole, but it's a loophole that's not being exploited by anybody. And unless absent evidence that it's being exploited, we should focus on matters at hand and not stuff that's what if.
Well, Representative Klayman, that was my impression and opinion as well, but it's since been brought to my attention that it actually perhaps has been exploited. But it's something for us to...
Any frequency?
Apparently.
And Chair Price Tompkins, if I may, I'd just like to state, so in side discussions with my committee aide, Eric Gunderson, I think it is an existing loophole that our bill does not address. I would say that by keeping the contributions uniform through the different levels of races in the state of Alaska, that it does minimize, it doesn't expand that loophole to any extent to where it provides an even greater advantage to make use of that loophole and run in that fashion. Thank you.
Representative Vance, I couldn't quite tell if you were looking to get in the queue previously.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm having to regroup my thoughts here, and I like the direction of having a unified contribution amount, much for the same reasons that Representative Klayman mentioned, but also for the public contributor's perspective. It's simpler. We want people to be engaged, and it's not necessarily about the dollars that they give, but it's about that action of engagement. And I think that that's a vital perspective that we need to have in this conversation. And instead of looking at it from our perspective as a candidate, you know, the purpose of this is for the public to be able to exercise their freedom of speech and engage with their elected representatives. But one question that I have for you that I feel like might be the elephant in the room as far as corruption goes, and I know that you're trying to address, you know, the case that brought this forward, but if we're wanting to help eliminate, you know, the quid pro quo and really outside influence being able to buy candidates, have you looked at the ability for independent expenditures to just have a wide open of outside influence into them in their impact on races?
Representative Vance, through the chair, no, we have not taken an extensive look at independent expenditure groups simply because through Citizens United, they have more or less opened the door to unlimited money into independent expenditure groups. And I think made it very clear that on the state level, we are not in the position to limit contributions to independent expenditure groups. So I tend to personally take issue with the ramifications of Citizens United, but it is the law of the land, and that's the world we exist in today. And so, no, we have not attempted to address independent expenditure groups.
Follow up. My concern isn't necessarily the use of independent expenditure groups, but I think most of us would agree that we like to have Alaskans influencing Alaskans. And I see that there's a value to have outside influence on a very small degree. How much say do we as a state have in that of who gets to have that influence? If the case said that, you know, they're not going to address that we shouldn't limit it, do we at least get to put a cap on how much outside influence contributions can be made to these independent expenditures? And is that something that you want to address in your bill?
Representative Vance, through the chair, the courts have stated that the only legitimate reason for us to limit that free speech is to avoid that appearance or actuality of corruption, the quid pro quo transactions. And there's no proof that an out-of-state donation has any more impact on a candidate and influencing their decisions or their actions in the legislature or in any of these seats. There's no evidence that an out-of-state donation has any more influence than an in-state donation. And that is, I think, the fundamental reason that they struck down the out-of-state limits and why we have not re-implemented an out-of-state contribution limit. I, again, personally disagree with the law. I wish it were different. I do think that we should have Alaskans providing the predominant voice in these elections. The law of the land, however, is that the only reason that we can limit those contributions is to reduce that appearance or actuality of corruption, and an out-of-state donation has no more impact than an in-state donation on corrupting a politician or prospective politician.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And I know there are some parts of the conversation that we had with the previous bill, which I think we're familiar with. I want to get your opinion on some of those as well, being a different bill and kind of taking a different approach. Now, in my own personal experience, I didn't have the traditional route, as was said earlier, running for House first and then running for Senate second. My first race, I was encouraged to run for Senate first. and found myself in a district that was a little over 25,000 square miles, which was a little bit hard to get around in. And so I'm wondering, based on the limits in your bill, we had this discussion about Senate versus House, and should the Senate be, you know, a higher threshold, and how high is high enough, and so forth. What are your thoughts on that conversation?
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Through the chair, so I did track that conversation earlier, and you know, I think it's a challenging question that you pose, because it does seem to make rational sense that for a Senate race you might want a higher contribution limit. You have to reach more voters. At the same time, you have more voters that may be inclined to participate in the election and make a contribution. And even further, and I think more to the point and more valid in the eyes of the court, is how do I look at a House or a Senate race and say that a $3,000 donation, or excuse me, $1,000 donation in a House race is less or more corrupting or more influential than a $1,000 donation in a Senate race? And so I personally cannot come up with the evidence for that, and so I think it makes sense from my perspective to have a uniform contribution limit across those races. I think there may be more of an argument there when you start to look at the federal races, but looking at in-state races, a uniform ceiling, I think, makes sense. Thank you.
Follow up. And for the 10 states that, you know, currently have chosen not to have any limits, I think one of the arguments that's been persuasive in some number of those states is the wealthy candidate, you know, scenario that we were talking about earlier, where if you have someone who's very wealthy and has instant access to money and runs a great campaign, at least as far as the money part of it's concerned, because they didn't need to go to anybody else for it. Whereas you have a less wealthy candidate who might have better credentials, might be a better legislator, might, you know, be more in line with the voters in that district, who has a disadvantage because they've got to spend a lot of their time, you know, raising money that the other candidate didn't have to, and who knows if they'll be successful and be able to compete, you know, on an equal footing. How do you see that? How do you address that? Obviously, you're coming in the standpoint of let's have this $1,000 limit. With that concern, what do you say?
That Representative Eastman, through the chair, I'd say that's a valid concern. I would also say that a valid concern is that a large contribution could influence that politician or prospective politician to be enticed into a quid pro quo engagement. So, you know, we're weighing these two, I think, very valid concerns. And when I look at those two valid concerns, quite honestly, I'd have to speculate as to how Alaskans would feel about an unlimited cap on donations. I do know, however, from the history in our state that Alaskans have expressed on numerous occasions a very strong desire to have a low contribution limit and a high degree of concern of corruption or over corruption. And so, again, you do raise a very valid point. It's interesting to think about having an election system in which we have no caps on those donations, but again, I'm when I look at this and I put this bill forward, I was thinking not just what might be able to pass the legislature, but what will also pass the red face test with the Alaskan public. And I think this does that. I hope that answers your question.
Final follow-up. Thank you. And I know the court has, the Supreme Court has looked at Alaska and has noted a couple of very unique things about Alaska. They noticed our economy. They noticed our dependence on, you know, one particular industry, that being oil. They also took time to point out that we have a very small legislature. And in fact, we have the smallest state house in the country and the smallest state senate for that matter as well. We could change that and make that less of a concern to the court and others by increasing the number of legislators. Have you considered that as something to do, maybe in contrast to the approach you've taken in this bill?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, again, a very interesting question. I enjoy these mental exercises. However, we, as I think I stated in the last hearing, it's my intent to keep this bill as narrow in scope as possible while achieving the objective of restoring contribution limits, which the Alaskan public really believe in and want in place. I think we all want to know what this next election cycle is going to look like, be playing from the same rules. And while there may be benefits to expanding the legislature, I felt that outside the scope of this bill and maybe too heavy a lift. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Representative Eastman, you might find a partner and Senator Kawasaki in that endeavor if you're interested. Representative Kaufman, we're going to consider outside the scope today.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor. I appreciate your comments regarding whether, as the way I took it, whether $500 or $1,000 or $1,500 is inherently more corrupting. I hope there's nobody that we serve with that would be tilted by that extra $500 in either case. I hate that that would be the case. With respect to the earlier question on the prior bill that we were hearing, I asked about the model of the two different supporters. So you have someone that is physically disabled in almost every respect, but they have the financial ability to support a candidate, as opposed to the other person who is immensely physically capable, but not financially well off. So in that case, the one can write a big check, and the other can just tirelessly work. You know, just they're just the super volunteer that is just out there. Do you feel that those, in the case of limits such as this, that there's equity between those two people in their ability to support their candidate?
To be through the chair, Representative Kaufman, to be completely honest, it's not something I've thought a lot about. I'd be happy to maybe come back to you with some thoughts once I've had a chance to mull that over, but it's not something that I've given considerable thought to, and I don't feel prepared to answer that right now.
I think another question to consider is, what if one volunteer is smarter than the other one? Is the dumb volunteer an inequitable contribution in the campaign than the smarter one? Anyway, there's a lot of variations on that theme, but Representative Kaufman, do you have a follow-up?
I try not to judge.
I just want to say I have no dumb volunteers.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, we'll call that good. And I see no one else in the queue. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Kleinman, you did have your hand up.
I want to pose a question that's partly in response to the question Representative Vance raised, which it's an interesting place about this kind of what has evidence of quid pro quo corruption. So that, and much is discussed around the oil industry. So a candidate today, whether it's actually a federal limit of $5,800 per House campaign, Senate campaign, if that's what we had adopted, or whether it's a $1,000 limit, if an industry were to decide that this was a race they cared a lot about, and then they put in an independent expenditure of $250,000 to that race, and it wasn't hard to figure out what industry was putting that money in. I mean, in the world of the potential for quid pro quo corruption, the person gets elected with having raised $50,000 from friends and neighbors and whatnot, and had $250,000 put in by independent expenditure by one industry. That seems to create a much higher risk of corruption than whatever we can do within the individual campaigns. And so I guess my question is there any way to deal with that in light of Citizens United?
Do you have initial thoughts? I'd like to pass that to my aide, Eric Anderson.
I have through the chair, thank you for the question, Representative. The court has indicated that donations from an individual directly to a candidate has a far less likely of influencing that candidate than, say, if I were as an individual to give the same amount to an independent expenditure group.
Let me follow up. I believe that's the correct point, but the opposite set of facts, that the courts have ruled that with an independent expenditure group, if you make a contribution to the independent expenditure group and then that independent expenditure group expends funds on that race, the risk of quid pro quo engagement is diminished substantially and that there's a much lower risk. And I certainly take your point to heart that there's certainly when $250,000 or some large amount is given to an independent expenditure and much of those funds are expended on a single or a few races, I think there's certainly a concern there. Again, we feel very limited by the courts and their rulings through Citizen United and others. And, you know, again, we've tried to stay within our lane and adjust and affect those statutes, which we can. Thank you.
Yeah. Follow up. I guess this is more of a comment. actually think if you tried to sell that to the public would have a hard time saying that the independent expense, the no, because with ballot measure two, we know the big contributions to an independent expenditure. I think the public would say, what is this, that we think there's less corruption with this huge expenditure independently and a greater risk of corruption with even a $5,800 contribution to a campaign? I guess I think that I'm not suggesting that you don't analyze correctly what the courts have said. I'm just saying I think from the public perspective, that would be sort of suspect. And I think that goes back to that larger question. Would we rather see big money going in independent expenditures? I mean, as we raise the campaign limit to campaigns, then somebody that wants to influence may be more likely to give to an individual candidate because they say, well, I'm not going to go spend $25,000 on an independent expenditure, but you know, I'm more than happy to exercise my free speech rights and give to this campaign up to, if we had an applicable federal limit, I'll give to that campaign. So there's a level at which the lower campaign limits to candidates raise the potential for independent expenditures. And I think there's a tension between those two.
If I might provide some brief comments in response, Chair Christ-Tompkins, Representative Klayman. I've really enjoyed my time in front of the State Affairs Committee, some wonderful questions on this topic. You know, I would be curious to see what Alaskans would say about that issue. I mean, given the impact of Citizens United, would Alaskans prefer to see campaign limits lifted substantially and or struck removed completely in order to help balance the field? Or would they rather us say, as lawmakers, well, given the results of Citizens United, we're unable to address the impact of independent expenditure groups, but for that which we can impact, state contribution limits, the impact direct to lawmakers, we'd prefer to keep those limits in place so that where we can avoid that risk of corruption, we're doing what we can to do that. We're right on the heel of an election. And so for our bill and what we're trying to achieve, we're trying to enact an immediate remedy to address the uncertainty around contribution limits today. I would welcome and be excited to see a ballot initiative or some sort of citizen engagement over what changes might be relevant in the years, in the out years, given the impact of Citizens United and how that has changed the playing field. So I certainly take your point, but again, there's a certain level of immediacy that we see with this bill, and I want to make sure that we keep the scope narrow enough, but still address the core concern so that we can make sure that we have an election that everyone can have faith in and trust in and confidence in. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sharkey. And I think with that, I'm going to set the bill aside. Excellent coverage on issues. And if there are any burning, pressing questions for the sponsors, rather than making ideological points during question time, we can consider that in final wrap-up of the bill and when we consider amendments, which amendment deadline is.
Questions for the chair is to
yes.
Representative Sharkey's bill and Representative Josephson's bill present kind of two different approaches to the question of campaign finance limits. Is the chair have, I guess it strikes me we should pick path A or path B, path Sharkey or path Josephson as we go forward, not disrespecting either, but it seems like we should try to pick one of the two paths if we're going to try to move this discussion forward and figure out what to do. And I'm just curious what the chair's thoughts are on that topic.
I am open to considering any piece of legislation which has the votes to leave committee. And so that mathematical constraint may guide the committee action. And I don't know where the numbers are. But we can find out, and or the bill sponsors can maybe run trap lines and do homework. So I'm open literally to the will that is the votes of the committee in terms of which of these two pieces of legislation or both pieces of legislation leave committee. But we'll have these bills back as noted. Amendment deadline 5 p.m. Monday for consideration on Tuesday, and can dig in then. And with that, we'll be back next week, 3 o'clock, for full 2 hours, both Tuesday and Thursday. And HB 251, I think we'll take that up another day, although that was noticed. And thank you to Sophia, Lydia, Jeff, and at 4:47 p.m., we are adjourned.